I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barber shop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, Sports Illustrated reporter Pablo Torre, and in the shop for the first time, journalist and screenwriter Nihar Patel. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas. What's up? Welcome to the shop.
Hey. Thanks.
P-Dog, A-Train, Nihar, what's up, dude?
Yeah,
welcome to the shop.
I don't have a nickname yet, do I?
You'll get one, homie.
Yeah, we got to work on it. Yeah. All right, well, let's get started with the federal budget and the fundraising blitz President Obama has been on. Now, he spent a lot of time this week stumping for cash for his reelection campaign, and he also made time to stop at the Facebook headquarters, Michelle, on Wednesday and held a town hall style meeting.
And we couldn't figure out if we couldn't find any evidence of any other head of state collaborating with Facebook. Maybe you shouldn't be surprised. Here's President Obama talking about ways to reduce the deficit.
So we've got to look at spending, both on non-security issues as well as defense spending. And then what we've said is, let's take another trillion of that we raise through a reforms in the tax system that allows people like me and, frankly, you, Mark, for paying a little more in taxes.
I'm cool with that.
I know you're okay with that.
That was Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's voice you hear chiming in at the back in case you couldn't hear it. I'm cool with that.
Yeah,
how much could those sneakers cost?
Yeah, I'm so happy to know Mark Zuckerberg is all in. Now I can get some sleep, guys. You know, what about you? What do you think this whole town hall thing was about? A-Train, you're up first.
Well, I think, you know, what's at the heart of the matter here is, you know, President Obama trying to reach out again to his loyal base. You know, the youth movement that sort of catapulted him to power in 2008, sort of the rock the vote generation. I think that there's been a great deal of, you know, disenfranchisement. You know, we haven't been able to shut down Guantanamo. We've, you know, doubled down in our wars in Afghanistan. We haven't gotten out of Iraq. So I think it was his sort of first way to sort of, you know, rally the base. I think that, you know, some estimates have that, you know, Barack will probably try to raise $1 billion, you know, by the time the presidential race starts. You know, he's hosting $33,000 a plate dinners and things like that. So it's good to get your base solidified before you try to get out there to the rest of the masses.
All right. Well, with that said, P-Dog, you know, it's like this. Now, check this out. Now, we can tell this Facebook thing was obviously aimed at his base. Mm-hmm. You know, but his base complains, you know, they're not saying a lot of them, but people like me, you know, I think he's overexposed. The man has a country to run. I don't want to catch him on American Idol singing Lady Gaga or somewhere else playing a saxophone. I'm afraid that his campaigning is going to distract him from running the country. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, he's stuck in this middle ground, obviously, where he needs to pass this budget, and yet he needs to look ahead for the coming reelection. And he needs to sort of figure out whether he wants to play hardball with the GOP, what kind of tone he wants to set. And for me, what was kind of mystifying about the whole Facebook thing was just that this seemed like an audience he didn't really need to cater to.
Right.
I mean, I understand that he wants to recapture some of that old campaign trail magic from 08, obviously, and that's perfectly understandable. He'll need to do that to win the presidency again. But this, you know, I don't see the Palo Alto computer engineer demographic being the one that he needs to worry about when he runs against Donald Trump or Sarah Palin or whoever it is. I agree with you, Jimmy. I'd rather see him, you know, again, it's unsexy to say this, but to be in the trenches and trying to figure out what's he going to do. I don't think a town hall meeting at Facebook, as much as I love those guys and I have friends who are over there working there who loved it, I don't know if that's really the best or even most effective use of his time at this point.
Nihar, he was out on the left coast, wasn't he? I mean, I know he was just in L.A. last night. Was he doing shots or how did his message go over while he was there?
How was he doing shots? He would have been drinking some, like, seagrass, you know,
wheatgrass.
Spinach, wheatgrass, thank you.
Right.
Wheatgrass teeny. That's it.
Right.
That's what's up. Go ahead, Nihar.
You know, I think when President Obama comes to L.A., everyone's concern really is, how is this going to affect traffic? And, you know, The traffic jams on the west side yesterday were pretty intense, and every Facebook update I saw pretty much related to that. But I want to get back to the Facebook town hall meeting. I looked around on Facebook to all my 800-plus friends, not to brag, 800-plus friends.
Only 800, bro? Go
ahead. Yeah, I was going to say, dog.
You're never going to get a nickname at that rate.
And I can't really find anybody who watched this thing. It seems like it's similar to a lot of other town hall meetings that I see, that unless there's a very quotable thing that emerges, you really only get the sensation of being there if you're actually there or if your question is asked. I mean, I just don't know if these town hall meetings and of course, the fundraising in California is always a good ATM for Democratic candidates. But, I just don't. I mean, did you guys watch it? I saw clips on MSNBC and Fox and CNN.
We get paid to watch it.
Right.
We get paid to watch it. But, can I just say this, though, before we move on? I think it's funny to me that, presidential communications is like childbirth. No matter what you do, as long as it's different from what the other guy did, you're wrong, or girl. You're wrong. You know what I mean? It's like people are fundamentally conservative about this kind of thing. Like, whatever you do that is not the old thing, you're wrong until you're right, until people like it. It's like, oh, anesthesia. Oh, no, you shouldn't have anesthesia when you give birth because you should experience the pain of childbirth.
And then when you get there, you're like, where's the needle?
Where's the needle? And then it's like, oh, no, you shouldn't, have a doula or have music playing because you're supposed to blah, blah. It's like whatever you do that's not the old thing that the guy before you did, you're wrong. So it's like you guys are
every guy that I've ever heard talk about childbirth had the exact same problem. You're right.
I'm just waiting for the Republican backlash against Facebook and they all move back to MySpace in response.
Right. Oh, snap.
Friendster hold town your breath on that.
Exactly.
Hold your breath.
Donald Trump is on Friendster right now. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, we're listening. We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop. We're with author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, Sports Illustrated reporter Pablo Torre, and journalist and screenwriter Nihar Patel. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, well, from federal budget battles to fights of another kind, the filmmaker Tyler Perry is out promoting his new movie, and he has some choice words for fellow director Spike Lee this week. Michelle, we got some tape, right?
We do. We do have time. For people who aren't familiar, the eight people, Tyler Perry has had this genre of films that not only that, I mean, he also did For Colored Girls, too, which we talked about a couple of times, but these Madea films that are based on these stage plays that he used to put on, around the country, and where he dresses up as Madea, this kind of grandmother character. And he's like a 6'5" African-American man. So that's the joke. Him with the wig. And then, of course, Spike Lee is the guy with, the darling of independent films, Do the Right Thing and
Malcolm
Jungle
X.
Fever, She's Gotta Have It, Malcolm X, so forth like this. And so there's that. So let me just mention that the reporter who asked this question at the press conference didn't mention Lee's name, that the reporter was asking a question about something completely different. But this is where Tyler Perry jumped in with his thoughts about Spike Lee. Here it is.
I'm so sick of hearing about damn Spike Lee. Spike can go straight to hell. Everybody, all y'all can print that. I'm sick of him talking about me. I'm sick of him saying this is a coon and a buffoon. I'm sick of him talking about black people going to see movies you vote by. This is what he said.
Now, can I just play another short clip here? And I'm not tooting my own horn here, but one of the things I found fascinating about this is that I actually interviewed Tyler Perry a couple of years ago when I was sitting in for Neil Conan on Talk of the Nation. And a caller named Gary from Detroit said he thought Perry's work was offensive to black people and kind of demeaning. So I just want to play a short clip of Tyler Perry responding to Gary's criticism. And the tone is very different. I mean, here it is. Do you find that painful?
No, not at all. Not at all, because there are people who have their opinions, but there are millions and millions of fans who cannot be wrong because they wouldn't keep supporting it. And I think what I have done is expose people. He says there's nothing new about it. Certainly there's a lot new about this level of success from initially from African-American people. There's a whole lot that's new about that.
So that's what I found. You know what I'm saying? His tone is like, hey, whatever. Brush it off, haters. But he's evidently... Spike pushed a button.
Yeah, I mean, it's this thing where it's like Tyler Perry versus Spike Lee. Thank you for that, Michelle. And what I don't like about Spike Lee is he wants to pretend that there's this some kind of black film renaissance going on, and that he's like the keeper of the black art film aesthetic, and he's not, and nobody is. Tyler Perry makes films to be entertaining, and to me that's really the first job of a filmmaker. Nihar, you write, you're a screenwriter. What do you think about that?
Well, I think,
pregnant pause. Go ahead.
Yeah, right.
Go ahead.
He's like, I'm trying to get somebody to hire me. I'm not trying to make anybody mad.
Who can I not offend by this answer? Exactly. That's what I think about. You know, I think I'm trying to think about it from Spike Lee's perspective. And, you know, Spike Lee made a lot of groundbreaking films and definitely films that, you know, I looked at as a child and thought, you know, wow, I couldn't believe that you could tell stories like this with people who weren't, you know, the standard Hollywood, you know, actor, white actor. And, you know, the Spike Lee joint, you know, as a brand, always stuck in my head. And now all you see is Tyler Perry presents this, Tyler Perry presents that. And, you know, I would think that if I was Spike Lee, the fact that the Tyler Perry Presents brand has kind of emerged, and in some ways it takes the place of, you know, the Spike Lee joint, at least as far as what is the most prominent brand in African-American filmmaking, you know, I would probably feel a little bit spurned, you know.
So it's ego.
It's somewhat of a rejection of the fact that, you know, Spike Lee made these films. He in some ways moved the needle as far as what Hollywood and what American audiences thought, you know, African-American films could be. And now anybody ever talks about is Tyler Perry Presents This, Tyler Perry Presents That, and I mean, that's the go-to brand now.
I do have to say that Spike Lee wasn't there. He didn't say anything to Tyler
Perry.
I mean, he has said otherwise that he doesn't, that he feels that this is not adding to the genre. I mean, and my question is, why doesn't he have a right to say that? I mean, just like other journalists have a right to comment on my work and say, this isn't what I think, you know, and they have, you know, to say, well, this isn't what I...
He absolutely does. And something I have noticed from watching Tyler Perry in interviews, and he was on Conan this week and I watched the interview, is he really feeds off that chip on his shoulder. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever seen an interview where he's on late night where he hasn't pointed out that, you know, he was walking down the Oscar red carpet and nobody knew who he was, or he was backstage at the Oscars and the guy thought he was, you know, the big kid from The Blind Side. I mean, you know, there's always an instance, it seems like, where Tyler Perry is like, I'm not taken seriously. I don't, you know, belong among you. And I know that. And I know that, you know, behind my back, you think my films, you know, aren't at the level that they should be, or you mock me, or you know, there's just a sense that Tyler Perry, you know, will create the conflict, or Tyler Perry will feed off the conflict, you know, even if, you know, a reporter asks a question and he's not directly responding to Spike Lee.
Tyler Perry wants his props. I'm not mad at him. Tyler Perry is one of the most successful black filmmakers for what it's worth, you know, of our generation. And, you know, he wants his props. He should take his props. You know, there's no way you should be mistaken him for the big kid or the Green Mile or Michael Duncan. You know what I mean? No, man. I mean, he's a brand. Yeah. He's a brand.
He just dressed up as Madea on the red carpet.
No, I like that. That's interesting. But I know you guys want to talk about the playoffs, and so I'm going to move on from that. But I did want to say, you know, there is a class element to this that's interesting to kind of think about.
Totally.
On the one hand.
Clearly.
Because Tyler's saying, look, people like my work. What's your problem? And Spike's saying, can't we do better? You know, why can't we have films that are more important, more interesting, more nuanced than this? And so I do think that, you know, I think both those conversations are worth having, you know?
Absolutely.
I don't know why people have to be. I'd like to hear the two of them talk about it together. So anyway.
It's not going to happen.
Jimmy, I know. Well, yeah. Come on. Tell me more. We're happy to host it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So, Jimmy, what else you got?
Well, Major League Baseball. It's taken over control over the Los Angeles Dodgers because, quote, there are some deep concerns about the financial trouble of the team owner, Frank McCourt, Michelle.
Yeah, you know, you guys had to school me on this. Apparently, McCourt had to borrow $30 million to meet payroll. Since his ownership began in 2004, he's burdened the team with more than $400 million in debt. And you all think I have a lot of shoes. The backstory has to do with a very ugly divorce. It seems like a soap opera. I don't know.
So, yeah,
that'll do
it. I didn't know
it.
About this until Pablo started talking about it. Go ahead.
Completely. No, it's completely a soap opera. It's a made-for-LA sordid tale. And it's funny because the Dodgers aren't really a bad team. They've averaged, I think, like 87 wins over the last 7 years under the McCourts. But the problem is that this divorce proceeding and the fact that he doesn't have any money has led Bud Selig to reach behind the curtain, from behind the curtain, as it were, and sort of lightly put his hand on the eject button underneath Frank McCourt's chair. And that's just something that doesn't happen very often. I mean, this is baseball taking advantage of the grand Oz-like powers it has to say this is just too embarrassing, too damaging to a brand, and quite frankly, too insolvent to go on. And the really funny thing is that Dodgers fans love this. Most of the time, a fan of a team really would be, you know, they'd be a little put off by the sort of unilateral action by the commissioner. Mm-hmm. But at this case, it's so embarrassing. It's so bad. LA has suffered so much from this ownership group really running the team in all the intangible ways and financial ways into the ground that they're all too happy to see it hopefully move on swiftly and soon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You know, this is Arslan. There's a special clause within Bud Selig's power. It's called the, quote, the best interest of baseball
right.
clause.
right.
And it's really interesting. So he's basically trying to invoke the best interest of baseball clause to try and facilitate the sale of the Dodgers. And what's interesting to note is if he does invoke the sale of the Dodgers, he's still going to need the backing of 3/4 of the 30 Major League Baseball owners. And so, you know, there is an element of consensus, you know, that will not be necessary in order to move this forward. This is not, you know, completely unilateral action.
Yeah, and God knows those owners don't necessarily want to have those special interests run right. down upon them in the future. So it'll be interesting.
Can I just quickly ask Nihar, you're out in L.A., do people mm-hmm. care? Do they care about this? Are they like, what do they care?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the Lakers right now are top of mind. But, you know, I think initially there was a lot of embarrassment that Bud Selig had to intervene like this. But I agree that overwhelmingly people are unhappy with Frank McCourt's leadership. And even from day one, I didn't mm-hmm. meet a lot of Dodger fans who thought, you know, he was the right owner, especially compared to Peter O'Malley and,
right.
and you know, the great
I'm available.
Teams the Dodgers
I'm
had
available.
In the past.
I could do it. yeah, I could right, do it. Right. I wouldn't bring the drama. I'm very right. stable. I could do it. I can handle it. I'm sure. Before we go, the yeah. NBA playoffs are in full swing. People are saying that Pablo, that this is the best season in years. True?
Yeah.
Yes.
Great opening round. And we're gonna have the Knicks against Arsenal Celtics tonight.
Down 0-2, baby.
Where are my Golden State Warriors?
The first playoff win in Knicks history. In a decade for the Knicks. Which seems like history.
Wow.
Go Celtics.
Go Celtics. You know what? I didn't get my buzzer last time we talked about the playoffs. Can I have my buzzer, please? Awesome.
Yes.
Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and author of the book The Denzel Principle. He joins us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Remember to check out his blog entry today at npr.org. Click on Programs, then Tell Me More. Pablo Torre is a reporter for Sports Illustrated. He was with us from our studios in New York. And Nihar Patel is a journalist and writer for Current TV's network's comedic news show, Infomania. He was with us from our studios at NPR West in Culver City. And Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, founder of TheMuslimGuy.com, and managing editor of The Crescent Post. He was with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thanks, everybody.
Peace.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.